to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information at lwvpdx.org. The League of Women Voters has online voters' guides, videos, and podcasts to help voters understand the state and local candidates and measures that will be on the ballot this November. Nonpartisan voter information is at lwvpdx.org.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, a special frontline report from Bangkok on the military killing fields over the border in Myanmar. Also, an update and deep background on the ongoing federal trial of the extreme right-wing group Oath Keepers and their role in Trump's attempt to overthrow the last presidential election. And we'll hear about a major international protest to save the life of political prisoner and globally celebrated political commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and please stay tuned. Coming up later on in the broadcast, we will be going to Bangkok. There are some very terrible things going on, and our courageous frontline correspondent, Jeannie Marie Halassy, is there. Wonderful filmmaker, courageous. We'll be talking with her. But first, we really are happy to welcome back to these airwaves a very fine reporter, Arun Gupta. He's been covering, among other things, he's been covering the trials of the Oath Keepers and has been writing some interesting material based on last we spoke, Arun, you had spoken with, I don't know if we would say the estranged wife of Stuart Rhodes, but you had spent 6 hours with her, and she, I guess she led you to believe that Rhodes and his associates are sort of, among other things, violent, sociopathic misogynists. You've been keeping an eye on the trial. I think it would be great if you just, again, gave a little context. What do the Oath Keepers have to do with Donald Trump and the attempt to undermine the election? Are they sort of Trump's soldiers, special forces in the field?
Yeah, so the Oath Keepers, there are more than 30 of them now who have been charged with various crimes in relation to the failed coup attempt on January 6th, many of them with seditious conspiracy, a rarely used Civil War era federal charge that of there basically being a charge with trying to overthrow the federal government violently. And if convicted on that charge alone, they could face up to 20-year sentences. It's very much a high-stakes case for the government. The last time that charge was successfully used was against Puerto Rican nationalists, I believe, in the 1950s, who invaded the House of Representatives. But the DOJ used it this time because that's what all the evidence points towards. And so if you are watching the trial, listening to the testimony or the reporting, you know, the government has done a good job of marshaling the evidence to show about how Stuart Rhodes, he was the founder, and he really was controlling all the strings at the Oath Keepers, which he founded in 2009. put together these various teams who invaded the Capitol on January 6th, and they were very much the tip of the spear of that horrible day, you know, where numerous people died, but, you know, where we also realize as problematic and as deeply flawed as American democracy is, it can get a whole lot worse. And so it's the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, you know, the kind of the fascistic street gang, male street gang, who were the took the lead in breaching the Capitol on January 6th, fighting with the cops, roaming the hallways, looking for members of Congress, you know, looking for Mike Pence. So, you know, they were leading this mob and to try and stop the certification of the electoral votes for Joe Biden, who had won the election fair and square. And they were, you know, essentially trying to stop that. And so that is the trial that is now going on, underway in Washington, D.C. And unfortunately, I don't think it's getting a nearly enough press as it should. You know, there's obviously a lot of things that are going on in the world, but this is really the most important trial yet to come out of January 6th. We've seen hundreds and hundreds of people who have received, you know, I've been critical, as have other observers, of these slaps on the wrist, right? You could there's just countless instances of peaceful protesters, if they're left wing, getting years long sentences for things that you would think aren't even illegal, you know, like chanting or standing on a sidewalk. But, you know, a lot of these January 6th defendants who are accused of entering the Capitol, you know, which was illegal, are getting probation, no prison sentence, $500 fines. But it is good to see that the government is finally taking more concerted action. But there, you know, before we dig into the details, I think the main things, you know, to take away from this, while the government is building a pretty powerful case, using Stuart Rhodes' own words, those of other conspirators, and they have flipped a number of Oath Keepers who are now testifying. One, there's a question, will it be enough? Because we have this pattern of right-wing extremists being let off scot-free by juries. And I think, you know, we should also really start to question, you know, when you have a white supremacist culture and society, what is the value of these jury trials? Because the Bundy brothers, Eamon and Ryan Bundy, who took over Malheur in an armed violent occupation in 2016, the wildlife refuge, trying to create an uprising against the government, they were acquitted. And a juror who was kicked off the jury, who was prepared to find them guilty, said his other fellow jurors wanted an absurd level of proof, that they were not going to find them guilty unless they had written a complete confession signed in blood. So, you know, there is this question of, even though the government case does look to be very strong, will they be found guilty? Then the next question is, even if they are found guilty, there's a good chance that Trump gets in and pardons them. You know, Trump hands out pardons like a candy on Halloween. So, you know, there's a long, hard road ahead with this.
A long, hard road ahead. That's Arun Gupta. He's a wonderful journalist. He's written for Washington Post, The Nation, Raw Story, The Guardian. He's written about this trial and about the Oath Keepers for, I believe, Raw Story, among other places. And he's been covering this trial. And it really is incredibly important. Now, they are facing sedition and a conspiracy to commit sedition. These are very serious charges, and they represent what was sort of really happening. But also, weren't these right-wing groups like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, weren't they a little bit frustrated with Trump, did they not feel that they were held back, and also that he didn't do his part in terms of declaring martial law? Wasn't there a little bit of a breakdown there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, you know, because the government has flipped numerous oath keepers, I think something like four or five at this point, they have access to many of their encrypted chats. And so we know on December 20th, Stuart Rhodes was texting to other members involved in this coup. And, you know, there's also a lot of overlap. Like on January 6th, he's actually texting with Enrique Tarrio of the Proud Boys. There's also an infamous meeting in an underground parking garage the night before between Enrique Tarrio, who's also in jail waiting trial. Rhodes was also texting to Trump confidant and dirty trickster Roger Stone, Stop the Steal Ali Alexander, conspiracist and battle conspiracist Alex Jones. He was texting all of them in a group chat on January 6th. In fact, even at one point telling them the back door of the Capitol building, as if, you know, giving instructions for where the breach was happening or should be happening. But, you know, right after the election was over, Rhodes started these encrypted chat groups with the idea that they're going to take action. And as January 6th approached, we're getting more paranoid, more apocalyptic. You know, Stuart Rhodes, as we've discussed this before, yeah, he's violent. He's his estranged wife, Tasha Adams, calls him a narcopath. She's like a narcissistic sociopath. She really described him as just an awful, vicious misogynist. But on December 20th, Rhodes texted, quote, either Trump gets off his ass, I'm not sure if we can cuss or not, and or use that word, and uses the Insurrection Act to defeat the Chi-Com puppet coup, or we will have to rise up in insurrection rebellion against the Chi-Com puppet Biden. Take your pick. And, you know, the Chi-Com, what he means is a Chinese communist, right? So this is, you know, Stuart Rhodes is someone who, he was all into the black helicopter and the FEMA internment camps in the 1990s. He was into the whole Y2K, where society was supposed to stop at midnight because of a software glitch, and spent a year prepping for that. So he's someone who's deeply paranoid, even though at by, you know, many accounts, he's also brilliant. He went to Yale Law School and actually won an award for his paper about enemy combatants. He won the Bill of Rights Award that year at Yale Law School. But he is this kind of like a violent, paranoid conspiracist. And he's, you know, someone who genuinely does seem to believe it, that we can see from the discussions he was having in preparation for the January 6th coup.
Okay, let me see if I could. You know, there's that infamous phone call now that we heard about coming out of the White House during the unfolding of this, that a White House official communicating with somebody on the ground. Was that the Oath Keepers? Do we know anything about that?
Yeah. Rhodes called someone within the White House, and he was trying to speak to Trump. You know, but I mean, that right there is pretty telling, that, you know, Rhodes was able to get to someone who is basically had Trump's ear, and the demand was refused. But, you know, that's how close he was to the man, not just the inner circle, but to, you know, the Fuhrer himself.
Situation represents a real expanding infiltration. I've never been much of a Republican, but not used to the kind of Republicans, I guess, in my era, that, you know, say we're going to burn this S down, Ali Ali Alexander, starting in Atlanta, all of these folks are all of a sudden welcome. They are the mainstream of the Republican Party that Trump's people say unleashed, opened up the door for this new world order, for people to say what they used to say in back rooms. How do you see this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's important. I think there's, I see this tendency from many on the left, not saying you, but a lot of people I encounter. Oh, Trump exposed what's already there. And I think that's completely wrong, because that views society as completely static. Trump definitely took things that were there, you know, the nativism, the racism, the paranoia, but he also turned it into something very different, right? You know, we are really seeing the consolidation of a fascist movement in this country and under the Republican, the GOP banner. And, you know, I don't want to like make like just silly and equivalences that this is like, you know, Nazism 2.0. It's a long way towards that. But if Trump gets into power, you know, he will be an autocrat, and we will, you know, really have not much of a democracy left anymore. And we'll see him use the state as his personal tool, either for profit or to take out any perceived enemies, you know.
And it will not be a world. It will not be a world that women in this country want to live in. This is what you learned in interviewing the wife of Rhodes. That women are going to clearly the synergy between the movement and sort of the autocratic movement right and the repression of women, the end of Roe, this is not going to be a pretty thing.
No, for a lot of people. But, you know, let's also, you know, remember, like, I mean, part of the real problem that I think we find is the Democrats were elected to stop this. And you know, I keep saying, like, look, you know, it's just like the Democrats know exactly what they need to be and should be doing. And they just instead offer endless excuses as if, like, Joe Manchin was a president and not Biden, and that Biden doesn't have this enormous... He is head of the most powerful institution in human history, the U.S. government, the executive branch of the U.S. government. And he doesn't have endless tools to bring people like Manchin and Sinema to heel, right? You know, why have we not seen any sort of election integrity bill pass? Why have we not seen a new voting rights bill pass? You know, just the climate bill is a complete farce. You know, the things like the student loan debt is just like just the smallest breadcrumbs, you know, even as they're just funding, they're turning essentially Ukraine into this like garrison state for NATO. And I don't want to get off on a tangent, but because I think this is extremely relevant to what is exactly happening and this fascist backlash that we're going to see in 2 weeks. Look, the Russian invasion is criminal, it's brutal, there's all sorts of war crimes, but unfortunately this is a reality of the world, you know, that there's all sorts of horrific things going on. We don't turn every horrific act into an existential struggle for survival, which is what we're doing with Russia, with just this most severe economic sanctions that have ever been imposed in political history, right? We're not doing that to what Brazil and Bolsonaro are doing in the Amazon, you know, just one of the most vital economic areas in the planet, what the Chinese are doing to the Uyghur, what India is doing to Kashmir, what Israel is doing to Palestine, and which we're funding, what Saudi Arabia is doing to Yemen, which we're arming them and funding them in killing 400,000 people, what we're doing to Afghanistan with brutal sanctions, killing tens of thousands of infants, what we're doing to Haiti with deporting, under Biden, since that infamous scene last year, right, in at the Del Rio Bridge in Texas with Border Patrol whipping Haitian immigrants, we have deported 25,000 Haitians illegally, denying them their right to asylum back to Haiti. We're deporting them.
You know what
death.
This is, Arun? You know what you're doing? This is a billboard of my show for the last 6 months. But I thank you for summing up stuff. And it is clearly, you know, it's you know how it goes. The poet writes about islands. Oh, for God's sake, they are connected underneath. You know.
Well, let me just finish this point, because your listeners will see how, exactly how this is connected. Because of these brutal sanctions we put on Russia, fuel prices have skyrocketed 90%. I say to people, do you know what's going on in Europe? And they're like, what are you talking about? The severe energy crisis, the inflation, the coming food shortages, not just in Europe, but even much worse, throughout the global south, where hundreds of thousands or millions of people are going to die because we have escalated this into an existential war. This is what is fueling the right-wing backlash in the U.S. right now. And now you see all this report that Democrats are running scared because they haven't been talking about the economy, and voters care about inflation, about the gas prices, about food prices. And Democrats thought they could just win it all on Dobbs and the ending of Roe v. Wade. And the media have been tracking this, and you see more and more. And, you know, Bernie Sanders has been saying for months, it is complete political malpractice to be running on Dobbs and how awful Trump is, and not to be running on economic populism. Why isn't Biden going after the oil companies every single day? Why isn't he calling for a windfall profits tax? And so the result of this is we can see Senator Herschel Walker, Senator Mehmet Oz. You know, the Democratic governor of New York State is running scared. It's looking like a red wave. And what you have is hundreds of extremists and election deniers who are likely to be swept into office because of the Ukraine war. This is emboldening and empowering fascism, and it's going to set stage, because you have all these right-wing election deniers who are running for secretaries of state and who will certify the 2024 election. We are witnessing the slow motion Trump coup 2.0 unfolding, because of just the completely warped priorities of the Democratic Party, that they care more about their foreign wars than they do about the public, about you and me, about the planet, about humanity.
Do you ever see what happens in a room full of liberals when you say something, Arun, like, do we think it's a good time to start maybe negotiating? Instead of saying, oh, those nuclear threats, they'll never do it, we'll never, no big thing. It would be, have you heard any, no, because this dialogue will not happen on corporate media, because you know, and I know, Arun, that essentially what they've become, particularly when it comes to foreign policy, is they are stenographers for the State Department, and a policy that has been bankrupt and includes, as you know, the Pacific pivot, which the idea is to control China and all parts in Asia by land, air, sea, and space. Welcome space war, the space force. You know what I'm saying, Arun? So I mean, these are very big issues, but maybe you can bring us back to where we started and let us go on our way.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think let's not forget one of the most important things about the Oath Keepers. I mean, for one, Stuart Rose is a mini Trump, right? Misogynist, yep. Violent, paranoid. But the thing about what he really tried to do, and that was such a success, was he was creating this extremist right-wing militia, and he very much was smart. He toned it down and tried to make it nonpartisan, and it was like it was opposed to racism. Stuart Rhodes is actually has Mexican-American heritage. But in, you know, he said that he didn't want to be a brown shirt for Trump. In the end, that's what it, and that's what Tasha Adams says. In the end, he became a brown shirt for Trump. But he was recruiting. The Oath Keepers was a reference to oaths that various oaths that soldiers and police take to uphold and defend the Constitution. So he was already back in 2009 creating kind of this like internal coup, recruiting military veterans and police officers as an anti-government militia. And that's what we saw the culmination of on January 6th. Rhodes is a former Army paratrooper. You know, other conspirators, Jessica Watkins, an Iraq war vet. She led Stack One, which was one of the two Oath Keepers stack that breached the Capitol. Thomas Caldwell, he was a Navy vet, naval intelligence. He was with the Quick Reaction Force, where they had an arsenal of weapons in Virginia that they were hoping to bring in. Rhodes is smart. He was a lawyer, right? So he was hoping Trump would invoke the Insurrection Act so they could come in guns blazing. One of the conspirators who's now government witness, Josh Dolan, he was a 19-year Marine vet who was deployed five times overseas, right? You know, just fighting all these foreign wars. And he said to his family that January 6th was going to be his sixth deployment, but this time it was going to be against fellow Americans with no pay, no coming back. It's just his quote, no awards, no homecoming. And if I'm lucky, I get a prison sentence tagged with treason or a bullet from the very people I would protect. Right, so Rhodes was turning the government against itself, and it nearly succeeded. And this is what we now see on a different scale, where these politicians who are now being elected, who are now sitting in Congress, are going to create an internal political coup. They are not going to need the outside military force any longer, because they are gaining the political strength to essentially create an autocratic state led by Trump.
Right, and we're out of time, but and just not to just to sort of bring the image home. Now we see things that you and I reported about in terms of what happened in Central America and the way in which
exactly.
The death squads worked. When we see in Arizona now armed men, a dozen in a truck, armed weapons, masks over their faces in front of voting structures. It seems to me this might be a violation, a basic violation of the Constitution. You're not supposed to be able to threaten people at the voting place. And one would say an automatic weapon and 20 men with masks might be a threat. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah. And I do want to leave your listeners with one quick final thought, right? You know, I think it's
okay,
really
go.
Important not to get overblown in our rhetoric. We're not talking
yeah.
about, you know, like concentration camps in Auschwitz.
But those, this example in Arizona happened with the men in the truck and the masks. This is
right,
make-believe. This happened.
We could be talking about Italy
yeah.
and the years of lead. From the 60s, 70s into the early 80s, where you saw the state security forces working with the right wing, engaging in like low level terrorism that resulted
yeah.
in some particularly horrific acts like the Bologna train bombing, which they pinned on left wing communists, but was carried out, that killed, I think, like 85 people, but was carried out by the Italian state security forces. So I think this is a type of thing we will see, low level terrorism that is either done with cooperation with the state or the state overlooks. So it is a an escalation, but we're not just going to go overnight into the Fourth
right.
Reich.
We agree on that. It's going to take a while.
Yep.
All right, listen, I really appreciate the reporting. Let me tell people that you're a great reporter, that your stuff is all over the place. You've reported for The Washington Post, The Nation, Raw Story, The Guardian, Jacobin,
Daily
and
Beat.
Lots of other places. And the Daily Beast. How did I leave that out? The Daily Beast, of course.
Some of my recent reporting on the Oathkeepers is.
Okay, at the Daily Beast. Thank you, sir. Be safe. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Dennis. Have a good night.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take just a very short break, and we've got to turn our attention to what's going on in Myanmar. Stay with us.
There is.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. We're happy to have you all along. We are not happy with the news coming out of Myanmar. We now go to Bangkok, I believe, where we're joined by Jeannie Marie Hallisey. She's a filmmaker, a longtime advocate for the people of Burma against Myanmar and against vicious military rule, which we have seen rear its ugly head again in the most brutal way and ways. Jeannie, welcome back to Flashpoints. Thanks for joining us today.
Tonight. Thanks, Dennis.
You're in Bangkok now?
Yes.
Can you take a few minutes to try and give us a sense of what you're witnessing and what you're hearing about what's going on? Hearing some very terrible things.
Yes, indeed, Dennis. Just to give your listeners a contextual overview, because Myanmar is not always on people's radar. You might have noted that Dennis also referred to the country as Burma because the name of the country was changed. It was ruled for half a century by one of the most brutal military dictatorships in the world. It's a country of about 55 million people in Southeast Asia, bordering Thailand, China, India, Bangladesh. And after this brutal military rule, there was a light that appeared for democratic change in 2015. And your listeners have probably heard the name of Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Peace Laureate, and her party began the first transitional period towards democracy in 2015. And civil liberties began to open up. The press, which had been strictly controlled by the military, began to open up. But all of that drastically changed last year in February, when the military seized power once again in an illegal coup, and that has resulted in the situation that we're seeing now. The elected members of parliament and ethnic leaders formed a shadow government called the NUG, the National Unity Government, and later last year, when they realized the military's response was going to increasingly be violent, they formed their own People's Armed Resistance Force called the People's Defense Force. So that's the context to give your listeners an understanding of what's happened. Now, going forward about a year and a half since that coup, what we are seeing is essentially a country that has really unraveled. Most of the country is now in a state of war. The military junta has systematically targeted not only areas of armed resistance, but also civilian areas. So this has resulted in over 1 million people who have been newly displaced, what are called IDPs, internally displaced persons. These are refugees who have fled in their own country, mostly ethnic villagers, women, elderly, children. There have been over 16,000 people arrested for any form of protest and over 2,000 who have been killed. But the war has really reached a new level, Dennis, this past week. And I believe I shared with you some of the video footage, if you want to refer to that, to set the stage of what has happened.
Well, talk a little bit about what has happened. I know that you sent that material. Say a little bit about what's happening on the ground now. It's troubling.
Well, this week has, this past few months, but this past week in particular, has seen some of the most heinous human rights abuses to date committed by the illegal military junta. Just days ago, and it's important for your viewers to understand that Burma, also known as Myanmar, is a complex country. It's comprised of many different ethnic nationalities, each of which have their own distinct language and culture. And these ethnic armed organizations have been waging what they would call a war of defense against the military junta for many decades. When Aung San Suu Kyi's party members fled following the coup, they have now joined forces with the previously existing ethnic armies to fight against this military. And one of the predominant ethnic groups are known as the Kachin. They are in the north of Burma, bordering China. And over the weekend, they were celebrating the anniversary of the formation of their political organization with a concert in a Kachin-controlled area. And three fighter jets flew over the concert while it was taking place and bombed the concert. The Associated Press has reported 80 killed, but the Kachin news media are reporting the death toll to be much higher. Among the killed were the two most beloved singers. These are, you know, kind of rock stars of the Kachin cultural movement who were there to perform. There were also children killed, and this bombing has been condemned in a statement, a joint statement by the United States, the UK, and the European Union, and rights groups such as the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners has called it a war crime and a crime against humanity. This came on the heels of a horrific incident that took place. The NUG, which is the National Unity Government, was spearheaded by a civil disobedience movement. People that were government civil servants in hospitals, doctors, nurses, teachers, anybody who worked for the government civil servants walked out of their jobs in protest when the coup happened. They have now set up their own parallel form of school systems, and one of their school teachers in an ethnic area last week was beheaded. His head was put on a spike outside the school. And the symbol for the resistance during the protests after the coup was to hold up three fingers. This was based on the Hunger Games series that was embraced as a symbol. His three middle fingers were cut off and placed by his groin in full view for the village and the school children who were coming there. This was then followed by a bombing that took place inside Insane Prison. This is the most infamous large prison controlled by the military in Rangoon, which is the main capital center of Myanmar. And this is the place where many of the thousands of political prisoners who have been arrested are currently detained. The bombs went off, followed by shooting by the armed guards in that prison. And many people were killed, including the mother of a very celebrated political prisoner, Ko James, who himself is paralyzed from the waist down from torture he received in military interrogation. And his mom was on her way to send food parcels to him and his friends in prison. Just days ago, there were more airstrikes in another ethnic area known as Karen State. The Karen are one of the other ethnic groups that I mentioned. These airstrikes are also targeting areas where school children are studying or trying to study under the most challenging conditions you can imagine. I shared footage with you, Dennis, that you could see, which is quite moving to see elementary age school children huddled down in a shallow ditch praying as the audible airstrikes are happening above them. Weeks ago, a school in Sagaing was directly hit by a military airstrike. 11 children were killed, including a boy who was severed in half but survived enough to cry out for his mother. So the atrocities being committed now have really gone to another scale of what some people are calling essentially maniacal behavior by this junta to sow terror and fear across the country.
Wow. And this has been going on and on. We're speaking with Jeannie Marie Hallisey, a filmmaker. She's talking to us from Bangkok, Thailand. We're talking about Burma / Myanmar and the violent nature of the military junta and the fact that there has been strong and consistent resistance to this brutality. And of course, we know, Jeannie, that the resistance is, you know, there's always been a battle going on, but it has definitely grown, I guess, in part to the brutality and the crackdown. It just got to the point where it seems to me, Jeannie, that people just, you know, that what was always a burning revolution is sort of blowing up here. Where could this go from here? What is the world saying? What are some of Burma's neighbors saying? What is the United States saying? What do we know? Anything about this on the corporate networks?
This area of Southeast Asia as a regional bloc, one could make a parallel to the NATO bloc that might be more familiar to your listeners. And here it's called ASEAN, which is the Association for Southeast Asian Nations, of which Myanmar is one of the members. However, since the coup, it was its proven record of violence of late, it was excluded from the last regional meeting. And just in fact tomorrow, the ASEAN members are having a pre-summit. There's a big summit coming up next month, which the United States also attends. The United States has a role, an observer role in ASEAN, as does Australia. They are having a special pre-summit meeting tomorrow just to assess its thus far approach, which has been failed toward its neighbor of Myanmar. Myanmar does border, as I said, Thailand, and this catastrophe that has displaced these hundreds of thousands of people who are fleeing daily from airstrikes, from ground fighting, from a complete state of chaos and terror, fleeing towards its neighbor Thailand, has proven to be utterly useless. The Myanmar junta has been impervious to the plan that ASEAN put forward last year following the coup. It put forward a consensus plan essentially asking Myanmar to curtail its actions and to move towards a negotiated settlement with those who are fighting against the junta, and none of that has happened. In fact, the military, if anything, has increased and stepped up its terror attacks against its own people. But there is a key role to play by ASEAN, because ASEAN is also impacted, not only from security reasons, with the outflow of these massive numbers of people and the instability in the region, but it also has, of course, economic repercussions in the stability of the region. Whilst this has been going on, it's important for your listeners to note that Myanmar enjoys stalwart support from China and from Russia. This is both in terms of massive economic investment, as well as the sale of military equipment, and not just military equipment and hardware, but also intelligence apparatus. So there are now widespread reports, credible reports throughout Myanmar, that the Israeli spyware known as Pegasus has been sold to the Myanmar regime. So to give you an idea of what that does, anybody who travels really basically more than a kilometer outside of their home now in Myanmar will confront a checkpoint. There are military checkpoints everywhere across the country. And anybody who is a human rights defender or an activist or supporting the resistance has to wipe their phone before they get on a motorcycle or a car to travel somewhere. They have to remove Signal, which is the only messaging secure system that's being used now. They have to remove their Facebook page. But despite that, what has been reported is that what the military are seizing at these checkpoints are mobile phones. And eyewitnesses whose phones have been taken have seen them put their phone on this machinery, which is Pegasus, which can read even things that have seemingly been deleted. It can actually absorb all of the data from that phone. And this is part of what they're using to track down the networks of human rights defenders and activists who are fighting against them. So what the activists globally and inside Myanmar are calling for are coordinated, targeted sanctions. That would be specifically looking at an aviation fuel sanction, because the use of these airstrikes has now gotten to the point where what used to be essentially a ground warfare is now largely being fought by the junta by air. And of course, none of the resistance forces, the ethnic organizations, and the newly formed PDF have air capabilities, nor do they have anti-aircraft weapons. They are also calling for a global arms embargo that would end the sale or transfer of any weapons or equipment, intelligence apparatus, including drones, which have been routinely used to detect not only where armed resistance fighters are located, but it has been used to detect any civilian movement. This has caused such a fear that children who are now have had their schools bombed and are now studying in jungle schools under the canopy of the jungle cover cannot turn a flashlight on or light a candle after dark, because the light will be visible from the drone and could target them for an airstrike. This is the reality being faced by millions across Burma right now.
Wow. All right. Well, listen, we're speaking with Jeannie Marie Hallisey. She is in Bangkok. We're talking about what's going on in Burma / Myanmar. I can't tell you how grateful I am, and I'm sure the audience is, to get this independent information from you. I'm hoping that some of the human rights groups that are supposed to be paying attention here are. It does sound at the moment, given the fact that they seem to be abandoned by the East and the West, that it's only suffering ahead for the people of Burma, who have been fighting for their freedom in one way or another for so many years and have been suffering so much because of it. We say we believe in democracy. Apparently not. How can people follow your work, Jeannie? Go on, please. We just have a few seconds.
The United States has imposed sanctions. I do want to say that. And they have been the largest donor for the humanitarian assistance for this crisis. However, there is no humanitarian corridor, meaning that there is no safe delivery point. Many of the refugees who have been fleeing have fled east towards Thailand, or they have fled west towards India. Some of the heaviest fighting that we've seen has been in the northwest part of Myanmar, which is in Sagaing and Chin states, and their nearest neighbor is India. But quite a large number of these refugees have fled to the border, so they're still on the riverbanks or in the jungle areas, not crossing over into Thailand, because Thailand is not officially accepting these refugees at this time. They are not a signatory to the Treaty on Refugees. But a humanitarian corridor needs to be established from Thailand in order to provide much-needed emergency assistance, particularly in terms of healthcare assistance that needs to be provided, medicine, food, and other forms of assistance for these people that have fled. If people want to follow what is going on, the website that I would highly recommend is aappb.org. That is the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners Burma. They give daily updates to the situation and are an award-winning human rights organization Dennis knows one of their founders, Kobo G, who was a former political prisoner, but they would be an excellent source to follow. If people want to support the calls for these targeted sanctions to be expanded, I would urge them to write to representatives in the House and Senate. Thank you very much, Dennis.
Thank you, Janine. We'll talk to you soon, all right? Be safe, safe as possible. All right, you're listening to Flashpoints. You're so welcome. And we really appreciate the courage there. That's the kind of reporting that we're here to provide for the people of the Pacifica Radio Network. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to tell you about a very important protest. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. One of one of the key leaders of the Bay Area in terms of action for the people, if you will, political action, and particularly political action in this long, long battle to free Mumia Abu-Jamal, who's a legendary political prisoner and an extremely powerful political writer of commentaries that have changed many people's minds and taught a lot to a lot of us. Jeff, there's stuff going on in terms of there's a move now, another opportunity. There's going to be some actions tomorrow coming up. Tell us what's going on in terms of freeing Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Thanks, Dennis. Yes, tomorrow in Philadelphia, before the Court of Common Pleas, there is going to be a decision of a local judge as to whether or not to grant Mumia Abu-Jamal a new trial or other legal proceedings that open the door for his freedom. This is after 40 years of effort in the courts, where we have been rebuffed and rebuked for the most reactionary reasons. Today, after finding further new evidence of Mumia's evidence of innocence, stashed in 8 boxes of stuff that have been kept from the defense, a judge will be considering whether or not the information that we presented merits a new trial or other legal proceedings. So we're having national demonstrations across the United States on Wednesday, October 26th, to coincide with the court hearings, asking all Mumia supporters to join us. In Oakland, we'll be mobilizing at the Federal Building at 12 noon at 1301 Clay Street, a block away from the BART station.
That's in the Bay Area. Also joining the discussion is longtime radical union activist, strong supporter of Mumia Abu-Jamal, Jack Heyman. I know you're going to be at the protest tomorrow. Tell us why, and why the unions care so much about freeing Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Well, first of all, it exposes the racist nature of the capitalist justice system in this country. Mumia is the most well-known political prisoner, and our union, which has always been strong on defending innocent people in prison, like Angela Davis, we naturally fell in line to support the campaign to free Mumia. We were actually one of the first unions to begin this campaign. And the demonstration tomorrow, by the way, Dennis, is going to the Oakland Education Association, the Teachers Union, will be present. Peace and Freedom Party, Freedom Socialist Party, Jeff's going to be there. Answer, and of course, people from Workers World and the Labor Action Committee to free Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And where are they going to be, Jeff? And what do you think they'll be doing? What should they write on their signs?
Well, we have lots of signs that you can carry that say "Free Mumia Abu Jamal." That's the main one, and we'll have tons of those and banners to free Mumia. So I want to say that, Jack mentioned the list of groups, which is a united effort on behalf of those fighting for Mumia's freedom for decades. And that includes my party, Socialist Action, as well as our mobilization to free Mumia Abu Jamal that has been around for close to 40 years and has organized some of the major protests in the United States, including raising hundreds of thousands of dollars for Mumia's defense. So this is a unique and new, if not unprecedented, opportunity that Mumia's freedom once again is on the horizon. We want a united effort of everybody to join us. Free Mumia Abu Jamal. Free him now.
Jeff, is there new information? Is there something that has come up that makes it more possible? Are there different people in place that might give folks a little bit more hope? Because what a struggle it's been, multi-decades, and police power has restrained our ability to free him.
Well, these newly found boxes of literature reveal that the prosecution has lied about Mumia's case, that the evidence of innocence that we have tried to present but has been repressed is now readily available, and we presented it in documents. This is a product of an unusual Supreme Court decision in recent years that says point blank that you cannot hide evidence of innocence, that says point blank that you can't exclude black jurors, that you can't have prosecutors who are supposed to be objective advocating the murder of Mumia Abu Jamal even before his trial. All of this kind of new evidence and witnesses is being presented for the first time. We've presented it for decades, but it has been banned. Now we have the written text that were sequestered by the prosecution in a strange place at the office of the district attorney that were suddenly found. So we're litigating new material and asking for the old demands. That is, for a new trial where we can establish the evidence of innocence and free Mumia and bring him home.
Jack, final
Dennis,
word from
if
you.
I could add three.
Yes.
If I could add three issues that are involved with these boxes that were hidden in the DA's office. Number one, the star witness, Chobert, the taxi driver. There's a letter in the file, him, Chobert, asking the DA for payment. Where's my money, it says. That's not lunch money. That's money for his testimony. Number two, the DA offered a sex worker, who was one of the witnesses, Cynthia White, to get rid of her convictions. And the third thing that's so outstanding is the DA himself, when they were questioning potential jurors, would put a W next to a white juror and a B next to a black juror, indicating that they were choosing jurors on the basis of race.
Based on color. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Listen, we're out of time, but I do thank the both of you. And again, where is it happening, Jack? Where are you going to be tomorrow?
It's going to be at the federal building in Oakland, 1301 Clay Street at noon. At noon. And the teachers union will be out there. And I think we'll see some longshoremen as well. Other unions are expected to show.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you, Jeff. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine over the Pacifica Radio Network. Free Speech Radio. Stay tuned.
That that wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice.